Time to take a look at the wonderful world of insects here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in today. We have Phil Pelletieri with us today, UW Extension entomologist. He works out of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him back. Thank you for listening in. You may have some questions. Are there some bugs that are kind of bugging you this time of the year? Or maybe there was something that happened last summer or last fall you're wondering about? If so, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. But also go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you've got a photo of an insect you want to identify, that's a great way to do it. Go to the page, download or put the photo up on our Facebook page, and I bet Phil will have an answer. Won't you?
Well, we'll try.
Okay.
Entomologists are good at making names up. So.
All right. Well, that's good. Are you seeing anything this time of the year?
I mean, I always get something. One of the things that was kind of fun to watch, and this kind of hit the fan about the first of the year, there's a creature we call the winter cuntworm.
Yeah.
It's a European species that's been in the state for about 10 years. And so after one of these 2-inch snowfalls, especially in the northwest part of the state, people were finding worms either crawling on the snow or crawling into their garage, and, you know, 3/4 to an inch long,
yeah,
dark grayish
stuff.
And, you know, what this thing does is over winter is a full-grown caterpillar, and it has this interesting pattern of being active at very cold temperatures, so that hence the name winter cutworm. And I had seen this phenomenon about 4 or 5 years ago, more in the Green Bay area, so this has been kind of the first time in the northwest part of the state, and so that was kind of a fun one. And they really have not posed any agricultural problems to us. The adults are really kind of an attractive moth. They have some yellowish in their hind wings, so they're related to some of the underwings, which are a group that's very popular with collectors. So that was fun. The disappointment this year so far has been, and we were expecting this, but there is a critter called a brown marmorated stink bug, which has been out east for about 10 years. And it's got two claims to fame. The first, it invades people's houses like Asian lady beetle.
Oh.
It's bigger and it's smellier, and so it's not a popular creature.
No.
Now, we had 3 or 4 intercepts where people had received packaging or goods from out east that came in. But what's happened in the last month is we had 2 specimens that were found in people's houses. What that suggests is we've got breeding populations. These are overwintering.
Boy.
So this is something that will in the future both be a structural issue, but also cause quite a bit of crop damage. And the apple growers are quite concerned. Raspberries, it even feeds on things like beans and things in the vegetable garden, tomatoes, peppers. And so this one is unfortunately anticipated to be a real stinker. It really is. And so, as I said, that was disappointing. And then I even got a stink bug from China.
It
was found in shipments that was not that species, a different species, and we have passed it on to USDA. So as I said, I've been keeping entertained.
Mary Beth's got a question for you from our Facebook account here. She'd like to raise orchard mason bees, but wonder about ordering native bees from another part of the country. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you can buy most of the mason bees that you buy, you know, on the internet or the like, are shipped out of the West Coast, but we already have the species here.
Oh.
And so what we suggest to people, I think that's the first thing, is just tell them we got that critter. And, you know, this is a very popular bee because it is, aside from being native, it is active earlier in the spring and at cooler temperatures than even honeybees. And so there's some attractancy there, especially for apple growers. What they do is utilize a hole that is 3/8 of an inch in diameter and basically the equivalent of a straw. And so if you provide that kind of environment, you will provide a habitat that will attract mason bees. And so some people use straws. In fact, one of the kits that you buy is basically that, a bunch of straws put together in a container. Or you can drill those holes into wood. The only problem is that they become plugged. The mason bees will raise their grubs in there, so you have to clean it out. So one of the interesting devices that I've seen made by some master gardeners up in Marinette County, they took a bunch of boards, put them together, put some screws through it, and then drill the holes in between the seams of the board so that when they're all done in the spring after the mason bees have emerged and the like, is they open it up, clean it all out, put it back together, and it's available to use. So I'm sure you can pick up various designs on the internet, but that would be my suggestion. And the interesting thing, if you make holes of different sizes, you attract different bees and wasps. But there's a whole lot of other critters out there that utilize that similar environment, and many of these are very, very neat native pollinators.
So that'd be kind of fun to do.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
absolutely. Kathy in Amherst, we are turning to you. Hi, Kath.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a vacation home in northern Wisconsin, and it is heated to about 50 degrees during the wintertime. And in the fall and ever since then, when we go up there, there are dead flies. There aren't so many right now, but in the beginning in the fall, there were a lot of dead flies. And there was a bug that wasn't quite a half inch long. It was black on either end of it, and in the middle, it had white. And someone referred to it as a saddle shoe bug.
Okay, and that name doesn't, but I have a suspicion.
What is it?
The flies that you have are cluster flies. And I'm suspicious this insect that's dark on the two ends and it has kind of this banding in the front is something we call a larder beetle. And honestly, larder beetles would breed on the dead cluster flies that are in the wall voids because they're a high protein feeder. And so we often see one begets the other in that all the dead flies are the food source for the larder beetles. So that would be my suspicion. Now, cluster flies are all about seeking shelter in September. And if you're trying to stop them, I mean, one could argue you could try to tighten the cabins up, but that's often difficult. But the other option is there are sprays that can be applied to the outside of the structure about the first week of September that will both prevent them from landing. There's some repellency there, but also kill them before they get in. But once they get access into, you know, the cracks and crevices in the structure, you can't do much about it. And then when you warm it up, they wake up. So some people refer to them as winter flies. And they will finally in April wake up and leave. And the interesting thing is these are earthworm parasites by nature. That's what they breed on in the summer, go through a couple, three generations. So if you prevent the cluster flies from accumulating, there won't be any food for the larder beetles, and you won't have the larder beetles, would be my guess.
All right.
There you go.
Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Got a cool picture here on our Facebook page. And if you're listening in and haven't gone there, go to the Larry Mueller Show. Take a look at this. It's emailers or the Facebooker is wondering, what's that insect on my owl?
Okay, so once we blew it up, I can kind of get enough detail. This is one of the orb weaver spiders, and these are pretty common in the late summer. And one of the characteristics is they remind me of a marble in that the large abdomen of the female is very round, often highly colored with oranges. This one happens to be a light tan with kind of cream markings on it. They make these big orb webs that you see, and this one may have just been crawling around, but they make great subjects for photographs. I mean, they're just fun to play with there. And the species are variable. There's a number of them. Many of them belong to a genus called Arrhenius, A-R-E-N-U-S. And that would be, in fact, this one looks similar to either the cross spider or the barn spider, but I, again, can't see the detail, but those are common names given to a couple rather common species. One that is orange with this cream colored marking, they often call the shamrock spider. So they said, interesting group, harmless, and very colorful, and you expect to see them in late summer and early fall.
And this one happens to be on, I said on an owl, but really it's on a statue of an owl. Looks like maybe a soapstone. Owl, and right on the eye, right on the owl's eye. So that's pretty cool. And that was from Kristen. Kristen, thanks for sending that. I really appreciate it. And David and Sabin, we'll turn to you next. You have a question or comment.
Yes, I do. Here in southwestern Wisconsin, we have a good deal of Lyme disease, and I've had it a couple of times. I'm interested, as spring approaches, the best way to prevent catching Lyme disease. I know about tucking pants into the socks. I know about putting DEET or some insect repellent around your ankles. Have either of those techniques been studied much, or do you have any additional techniques?
Yes. Well, the idea of having as little exposed skin as possible is just, a way of preventing them. But what you have to be careful of is that if the ticks are hitchhiking on your pants and you take your pants off and, throw it in the corner, then the tick is still out. And so there's two ways of treating. The DEET is just a repellent. It doesn't kill the ticks. And DEET is registered both for on clothing and on skin. And in the trials, it's about 97% effective, at least the research that I'm familiar with. What I use, to be honest, is a different technique, and it's a product that's sold as a repellent, but it's not a repellent. It's an acaricide, which means it kills the ticks. And the active ingredient is permethrin, and it is sold as a clothing spray. It is not registered for on skin. But the concept here is that if you spray your pants and the tick walks on it, it will die. It will die in a matter of an hour or two before it has any opportunity to transmit the disease. And so the studies side by side that I have seen have suggested it's close to 100% effective. And the thing about spraying your hiking pants and the like is you don't have to spray them daily. The permethrin will basically work for at least a couple weeks. In fact, holds up probably until a good washing. For people that are active all the time outdoors, you can even buy outdoor clothing that's impregnated with this. The Army had worked up this technology. To me, again, you know, if you're an area in the southwest part of the state the whole western edge of the state is really more prone to both the deer ticks and Lyme disease, although the interesting thing is we are definitely seeing a buildup in the southeast part of the state, which is somewhat unique. And, you know, the cases, I haven't seen the data probably isn't in yet for 2011, but we had 3,500 human cases in 2010. And so it just continues to climb. And so if you're an outdoor person, you really do have to take precautions if you're in areas that have these ticks.
May I ask two quick follow-ups?
Sure.
Oh, good. Do you have a name of a product that includes permethrin? And I have my dog vaccinated against Lyme disease every spring. Is there a vaccination on the horizon for people?
Well, there was one on the market, but honestly, there was two problems with it. It took three shots over an extended period of time to build up the antibodies, and it still wasn't 100% effective. And so the company has withdrawn that product from the market.
Yeah.
You know, the dogs, it does help. Does it totally protect them? I think you still have to have some concerns with that in particular, because, as they said, the vaccines help. But if you understand how vaccines work, they don't necessarily give you 100% protection.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I have a question for Phil as we talk insects with him. Are you noticing many insects right now having trouble indoors with any insects? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a photo or a question or a comment there. And Judith Sears-Poisson will answer the phone when you call here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today as we talk insects with him. Phil, UW Extension entomologist. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And all of our lines are pretty well filled up. Go to our Facebook page. We just had a photo posted, and I'm going to go back to it. Glenn posted this photo. Never is at his home.
Mm-hmm. He's got a big dragonfly, and this particular species, I'm guessing, I don't have my dragonfly book, but it is one that is sometimes called the black saddlebags, because it has distinctive pigmentation in the back wings that remind people of kind of a saddlebag on the creature. You know, we have, I'm guessing off the top of my head, about 45, 50 species of dragonflies at least in the state. And, you know, one of the interesting things I've seen in my career is, you know, way back when I started, it was hard to get field guides for things like this. But there's a number of very good field guides, both to damsel and dragonflies now. And so people who have an interest have a much better chance of identifying some of these things. And again, the internet has got some great resources. So as I said, it's one of the skimmers. The family is Libellulids. And as I said, I think this is the black saddlebags, if I had to guess. And neat creatures, much better mosquito eaters than the purple martins that get all the press. But, you know, and so yeah, you're hard pressed to say anything bad about dragonflies.
Absolutely. We should talk about Garden Expo for a minute here, because you're going to be at Garden Expo. You and I are on the docket together with Shelley Ryan and some other folks.
Yeah, I'll be there both all day Saturday and all day Sunday. I'll be giving a couple talks in the afternoon of each, and also we'll be doing that piece with Shelley, kind of celebrating the
20
Wisconsin
years,
Gardeners.
Yeah, 20 years of Wisconsin Gardener, and that's from 10 to 11 on Saturday morning. So that's the 11th.
Right, in Mendota 6 and 7, I think, is where we're doing that.
Mendota 6 and 7, and we'll be, and of course, then I'll be at the public radio booth right after that, and Judith will be there too. And we, You know what? Let's give away some tickets. If you'd like to win a pair of tickets to Garden Expo, it's this weekend. Go to my Facebook page. We're going to do it on the Facebook page today. So go to the Larry Mueller Show and leave a comment to the status update that Judith just posted that talks about winning tickets. And you'll need to like the page in order to post the comments. So tell us the city and town where you live and the name of your favorite Garden Talk guest. And we'll do a random drawing of all the people who post in the next 10 minutes or so. And five people will get a pair of one-day tickets to Garden Expo. The tickets will be at the Will Call booth. And so we'll start that right now. So again, tell us the city and town where you live, name of your favorite Garden Talk guest. We'll do a random drawing of all the people who post in the next 10 minutes. You need to go to the Larry Mueller Show. You need to like the page in order to post a comment. If you don't win today, or if you don't use Facebook, you can also go to www.wpr.org/Madison to enter to win there as well. They have some different ones. But go to my Facebook page, at the Larry Mueller Show. That's what we're looking for. And we've got an email from Chris. Phil, can you offer up a good, safe solution to keeping wolf spiders out of our seasonal home in Northern Door County? They're much too scary to find indoors.
Wolf spiders are nighttime hunters, so they're out wandering looking for food. And we really never spray for them. The issue is if they're finding that easy of an access, there has to be a plumbing chase or a door that needs an improved door sweep. It's all about physical. And so you look where every, you know, piece of pipe work and electrical work and other things come in to the outside wall and make sure that those are caulked or steel wooled or somehow sealed in a way that these spiders can't come in, because, you know, it's not their purpose to come indoors. It's more kind of a wandering by accident. And if they're finding that easy access, hopefully you can identify the physical, thing to prevent them from getting that access point.
Well, here's an email. This is an interesting one from Mark in Madison, who says, even though the Postal Service managed to smash the tiny fly into pieces, Phil managed to identify a creature I mailed to him a couple of weeks ago as probably a fungus gnat. In answer to his question, we only have houseplants in every room of the house. I suspect it was imported in some potting soil. Is it possible to identify the pots that are harboring them? Is there a way to get rid of them short of repotting all the plants?
Yes. Okay, so the first thing is identifying the plant. Something that has worked for us in the past is to take a potato and slice it in probably about a half inch or so thickness and lay that potato slice on the top of the soil. Come back in about 2 or 3 days, and what typically happens is that starts to degrade a bit. The fungus gnat larvae, which are little black-headed, either white or clear worms, come up into the potato. So it's kind of a monitoring tool, and so you can identify the pots of... it's not so much potting soil typically if it is, you know, vermiculite in a lot of the inorganics. That it's more garden soil that we have the problem with, because that has the organic matter that supports these creatures. But even if you start with the right stuff, if you got dead leaves and other things that land on there as they decay, that's adding organic matter to the soil. Now, treatments, there is a bacterial insecticide that you can get at some of the plant stores that is a particular formulation. We call it BTI for short. I've seen it sold under the name NatOut or NatTrol, G-N-T-R-A-O-L. I've also seen Gardens Alive, and I can't remember their particular name for the product. So it's a pretty non-toxic way. You sprinkle the bacteria into the soil. The larvae feed on it and die. They literally, their gut tract shut down. And yet, if you've got pets, kids, it just doesn't have any toxicity there. So that's probably the easiest way to work with it. It turns out that most insecticides that are registered for, and it's hard to find products that are registered for houseplants other than insecticidal soap.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't work so much. But some of the other products, if you can find another product with a pyrethroid or whatnot that's a dust formulation, you just dust the top, go through the normal watering. But as I said, I think if you chase down the BT product, that would be a way. Repotting gets a little difficult because unless you wash the roots completely all the soil off and put it in a brand new sterile environment, there is no guarantee. So as I said, I think just spot treating the plants that show you the problem is the easiest way to go and should solve it. They do talk about trying to hold back a little bit in the watering to make life a little bit more difficult. But of course, that's a tricky thing to do because the plants need a certain amount of water. But definitely we know if you overwater, you're making life more reasonable for the fungus gnats.
Jean in Ashland, on to you now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Quite some years ago now, I heard that 17 counties of Wisconsin had found Asian tiger mosquito, and I was wondering how that's coming along as it progressed north.
Sure. I have personally not heard of any counties. The closest Asian tiger mosquito that I had ever seen identified was in Chicago. Now, there is another one, the Japanese rock pool mosquito, was a species that was picked up about 3 or 4 years ago, and it wouldn't surprise me at all that's now been picked up in 17 counties. Where that was a concern is it's kind of a northern version of the Asian tiger mosquito. And what concerns us about that group of mosquitoes is they readily breed on your property in flower pots and the like. And secondly, they in general are efficient vectors of things like West Nile virus. So, you know, it kind of...
What about dengue fever? Isn't that what Asian tiger?
Both of those are capable, although, you know, dengue is not... we've had some problems down in Florida and whatnot, but it's not really, you know, progressed this far. So, you know, it's one of those things that it's been interesting to watch because with the Asian tiger mosquito becoming established in the southeast part of the United States, you know, the medical entomologists have said this is a potential, you know, that we have mosquitoes that are more efficient of transmitting these organisms, but we haven't seen a big problem yet. So it's one of those things that I think people need to be aware of it. Is it crying wolf? No. But will it guarantee that we'll have more diseases? No to that question, too. So it's been an interesting one to watch. Hmm. And
what about mosquito netting? You can buy it for hanging over your sleeping area, and you can it's untreated. If you wanted to treat it, what would you spray it or dip it?
Well, what they're using in Africa is permethrin, the same product that we had talked about for. And I would guess you might be able to mail order already permethrin and impregnated bed nets. I mean, that's what they're using for malaria control. And you know, that would be an easier thing to work with in trying to treat it yourself. Could you spray it lightly with this spray? Yes, you could. But the impregnated stuff, my guess, would have quite a bit longer residual, the way it's impregnated into the fabric itself rather than relying on the spray.
Yes, What kind did you say it was?
Permethrin is the active ingredient, P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N.
Yes, you mentioned brand name or something?
Well, when the person had asked, the product that I've seen most commonly is called Permanone, P-E-R-M-O-N-E, but there are definitely other products. The one thing I would suggest, I've had better luck at seeing these things sold at sporting goods stores than I have at drugstores.
Yes, absolutely. You see them a lot at drugstores.
Sporting goods. Because, you know, people, you know, trout fisher people and whatnot that are getting out a lot are getting a lot of exposure. So you kind of find this in the camping gear section of things.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Percy in Marshfield, it is your turn. Hi. Percy, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. I have a problem with mealy bugs coming into the house and affecting... I grow orchids and some fruit trees, and they've destroyed several. I don't know how, where they come from.
Well, the first thing is mealybugs typically are a tropical plant critter, and so rather than finding them outdoors, somehow, unfortunately, I think they're coming in with new plant material you have. And then once they get access, they feed on a wide enough variety of things that they can be very difficult to control. And the first reason for this is that they have life stages, both their eggs and in some cases the adults that are covered with all that waxy material, that are very difficult to kill. And so the first thing is if you're relying on a foliar spray, it takes 2 to 3 sprays spaced about 10 to 14 days apart. And we do use insecticidal soap quite successfully. It's a product that's easy to work with. The only dilemma with the soap is you need good coverage because there's no residual. So that's one option. Another option for some of the plants is there are these little plant capsules that you can put in that have a systemic insecticide. and the roots will uptake it. And the product that they're using in there is imidacloprid, which is a neonicotinoid insecticide, and it really is quite effective on sucking insects. But for the bigger plants, the woody plants that you have, the dilemma will be is that this product will slow the mealybugs down for maybe even as much as 60 days. But when you rely on systemics, they do not translocate well enough in older tissues. So what you tend to find is a certain survival factor. So the mealybugs, as soon as the product starts working, kind of come back at you. You think you've solved the problem, but ones that have been on older tissue are not getting exposed to enough insecticide in their feeding to be affected. So those would be the two options. You can rely on the soaps. There are also some oil treatments that work in a similar manner. They're more as a suffocant that can be used, but you need the repeated treatments and thorough coverage for that to be your strategy. And for the bigger woody stuff, as I said, it may just be as easy to find these plant capsules. The most common one I've seen has been a Bayer Advanced product. And again, they'll tell you, depending on the size of the pot, how many capsules you need. You go through your normal watering. But do remember that you'll have to watch those plants, because within 60 to 90 days, you may see a little bit of a resurgence and they may have to be retreated.
Hmm. So, are they coming in with a sort of soil that?
Probably not. They're not long-lived off-plant material. And so what I tend to see typically is whether they come in on foliage plants or potentially the orchids.
That's the problem. Those are where I'm getting them.
Yes, yes. And so, sometimes it's a good idea for people who like plants to have an isolation place where they can bring new plant material in and let it sit there for a couple months. Just in case, again, you're bringing in this kind of problem, at least then it doesn't spread to the rest of your plant collection. And so I often suggest to people, if you got a room that you can do that, it's a good way of reducing. And then the other trick here is when you're watering your plants, make that the last place you go. Because to be honest, these little mealybug, what we call crawlers, which are the immature stage, can get caught on your watering can, and then you transfer them to your plant collection. So as I said, water everything except these isolated plants. Water them last will prevent that as a way of spreading the little critters.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Percy. Larry in Two Rivers, on to you. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. About a year and a half ago, we had a new roof put on our home. And at that time, the carpenters found two moisture-damaged spots where there were carpenter ants. They sprayed them and continued with the roofing project. Within the last week or so, we've had unseasonably warm weather, and I've noticed 1 to 4 carpenter ants in the home on the floor here and there, and they've destroyed them. Should I be concerned further, or is it just unseasonably warm weather activating them?
Yeah, there's no way that the carpenter ants that are out near trees outside have woken up yet. And so what this does indicate is that there is a colony somewhere, and it may or may not be related to that. Was this soft wood replaced?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so that would have solved that problem. So it could be another colony. What I always tell people is I at times think that we made a big mistake calling them carpenter ants, because the reference was that they nest in rotting wood and stumps, but people often, I think, equate them to structural damage in the house, and you really just generally don't find that. Much like you experienced, is you had a leak problem, the ants exploited that environment.
But they didn't cause it.
The water caused the damage. But they don't have to be in water-damaged wood. I see them in styrofoam. I see them in hollow core doors. I mean, they're looking for various environments. And the trick here now is to be enough of a detective. Now, my first thing, depending on what you've explained, is that it sounds like they're in an outside wall. If they were someplace that stayed above 50 degrees all winter long, which would be more the interior of the structure, you could have seen ants in December or early January. When they equate more with this unusual warm conditions, so that, again, you, between the sun and your furnace and what's going on, that your walls start to warm up enough, you're waking the ants up, and what you're going to see is they're looking for water. The reason is they want to bring water back to the colony so they can start getting the humidities up so they can start raising their young. And so that's just the normal dynamic. They probably aren't going to be very interested in food right now. They may be in a couple months, but that's why the baits don't work this early. But if you can try to keep track of what room you're seeing them in and what the pattern is, to try to focus where the nest is. Because once you find the nest, it's very easy to take care of with a couple squirts of any ant spray. The ants you're seeing now are sterile females. And you can kill all the workers you want, and if you don't get to the queen that's living in the nest, there will still be a nest. And so whether you kill the ants you see now or not isn't as important as trying to figure out where the little stinkers are coming from.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Email from Tim in Northwest Wisconsin. He has sow bugs in his basement. What's the best way to get rid of them?
Well, the argument with sow bugs is that they're likely not breeding in your basement. They're falling in from outside. Sow bugs are common in moist areas that are rich in organic matter, and they sometimes come crawling in the house, and the basement's the place that's cool and damp, so they'll do okay there, but they can't breed because there's no organic matter. So I just say sweep them up downstairs. And if it's a serious problem, you look at two things. If they're getting in that easy, you know, and, you know, sometimes there's just so many cracks in the foundation or whatnot, that's not feasible. But getting things sealed up in that interface between where your siding meets the foundation, there's often a spacing they can crawl up underneath. And so getting in there with expanding foam or steel wool or something so it's a physical plugging really solves the problem many, many times. Now, if that doesn't work, the other option is you don't spray indoors, which is kind of worthless. You spray outside along the foundation, and we call that a barrier treatment. So there's plenty of products you can get at the discount stores or at the hardware store that can be made to spray the outside. But my argument is that that has to be done annually, at least, maybe even once in the spring, once in the fall, whereas if you figure how to seal things up and get them, you've got a permanent solution.
And on our Facebook page, we've got yet another photo of a butterfly, Red Admiral.
This
maybe?
Is a Red Admiral. Very good.
Yeah.
So now, that butterfly, you know, we have a handful of butterfly species that overwinter as adults. Now, Red Admirals probably migrate in here more than they overwinter as adults, but I do see morning cloak butterflies. I see some of the comma butterflies, which are in the same family as this particular species. And so on some of these crazy days that we've been having, you know, I have had a couple calls of people that have seen butterflies.
Wow.
And, you know, they wake up in these 40-degree weather, and hopefully they're smart enough to find a place to crawl into an old woodpile or something to spend the rest of the winter. So,
Dan in Highland, on to you. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I have a question. I get a spray at the local store that you spray for bugs around your house, and it'll last 1 to 3 months. It's an ortho spray, but it doesn't seem to work real well on spiders in the rafters in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's a specific spray that I could get for the rafters in the basement to protect from spiders.
Well, you know, what we have found that honestly powdered or wettable powder sprays tend to work better than liquid sprays on spiders because the powder gets on the web itself and then when the spider is going through it. But I'll tell you, we've had as good if not better luck just getting down about once a year, maybe twice a year with a vacuum cleaner and get the attachment so you can get in all those nooks and crannies. And that probably works as well. Now, the spray that you put on, the argument is, spiders must eat insects, and you're getting a residual out of the spray you've got on, so you're taking the spider's food source away. So, you know, that does help to some degree, but I think your experience that it really by itself doesn't kill the spiders is kind of what we've experienced too. And as I said, so either you have to go with special formulations, but I just find, you know, that because most spiders breed relatively slow, and that's why the vacuum cleaning sanitation tends to, you know, keep up with them. So,
okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And on to Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric. Eric, are you with us? I think we lost Eric. All right, well, let's try Dennis. Dennis in Ogdensburg, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi, how can we help you?
Say, I'm interested in attracting solitary bees into my garden in the summer. And I've heard before that you can, like, take planks or boards and drill holes in them to make nesting, but what I'm not sure about, now I have a note that I wrote down once that said you make the holes 5/16 inch around and 3 inches deep, but what I don't know is, do you put them in the shade, do you hang them on a building, do you stick them where, you know, what's the best positioning? I've tried it before and got a few that holes that got filled up, not many, and then red-bellied woodpeckers would find them and eat them.
Yeah. Oh, no.
So I'm thinking I should, if I put lots and lots of them around, then I'll overwhelm the woodpeckers and get some of the bees to show up. But where do you put them? In the sun? In the shade?
Well,
on the ground?
Or typically you'll see where people try to set them up is so that the opening of the hole is facing to the east, so it's catching the early morning sun.
Okay.
So it kind of wakes them up and gets them active and the like. And in some cases I have seen just old pieces of firewood drilled for this, and they've hung them from overhangs, so they get them up off the ground to help keep them away from some of the predators that are on the ground that would go after them and the like. And as I said, in the different size holes, you know, will attract different species. So I think it's well worth playing around with that in using different holes. You know, again,
is the depth of the hole important?
To some degree, 3 inches is probably the minimum depth. It wouldn't hurt to go a little deeper, but you don't, you know, more than 4 or 5 inches, you usually aren't going to find out.
I was thinking if it was deeper, maybe that would put off the woodpecker.
Well, that would definitely prevent them from getting access to anything other than the grub that's right there on the entrance. And, you know, you find what's so fascinating about the way these things, you know, the bees are all pollen providers. So they put the pollen ball in there, lay their egg, and then their grubs develop on their own. So that's why we refer to them as solitary bees.
Right.
But you figure that the ones that's deepest in there was the first one that was set, and to be honest, that will be the last one to come out. And so because
if more than one per hole.
Oh, definitely. You will often find it's almost like a cigar that you'll find 6 or 7 grubs. In fact, the leafcutter bees partition between one grub chamber and the next with little pieces of leaf.
Oh.
And that's the ones that cut those little kind of half moon holes out of your rose bushes. That's what they're using these is to partition these or chamber these little things. So as I said, there's a whole group, a fascinating group to work with. And it's one of those things. If you provide the environment, they will come.
Okay. And one other. Now, last year I also found what I identified as, I think they're called pseudo bumblebees. Is that the right term?
Well, there are some parasitic bumblebees.
Yes,
that's what
the book said. They were parasites of bumblebees.
But they are bumblebees themselves. It's just a different genus.
Yes, and are they good, bad?
They're good. I mean, they are still pollinators. It's just the unfortunate for the species of bumblebee that the queen takes over. Right. She's got slave labor to help her raise her young, and it again affects the one species. But this is a natural, you know.
I'm curious, are those ground nesters as well? Bumblebees?
Because basically, again, they're utilizing a nest that's already been found by one. Bombus is the normal bumblebee species.
Yeah.
Pithyrus is the genus of parasitic bumblebees.
Right, and I seem to have both, but last year, in the fall on my asters, there was just an amazing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds every day, and I hadn't noticed them so much before, so that's why I kind of looked them up, and I was curious if that was bad sign for the bumblebees or if it's just another animal in the mix and good for the pollination.
Yep, definitely, the latter.
So face these bee nests to the east is about the only thing to... Does it... Good that they get the shade the rest of the day then, or can they just be out in the open facing east?
If they're totally exposed, my concern would be heat-wise, we might get into some trouble. So as I said, you know, to have some shade in the afternoon really is, it won't hurt things.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. We have the winners from our drawing. We have 5 pairs of tickets to the Garden Expo in Madison, which is coming up this weekend, February 10th through the 12th. Again, Phil's there the whole weekend. I'm there on the 11th in the morning. From 10 to 11, Phil and I will be on a panel with some other folks, which will be a lot of fun. And then I'll be at the radio. We have a booth there, so I'll be at the booth talking to folks there from 11 to 12 for sure. So those things coming up, and we've got the tickets, and we've got the winners. So Laurel S. from Madison, Beth W. from Merrill, Peggy H. from Apple River, Illinois, Andy H. from Oregon, Wisconsin, and Chris S. from Madison. And all you need to do, we'll have your names at the Will Call Center, so you'll get your free pair of tickets to the Garden Expo. So, and they're good for one day, so pick a date, come on up. Rebecca in Madison, it is your turn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interested in the pesticides that you have talked about killing bugs, and just wanted to get comments on how you feel about natural pesticides. I've used all kinds of tonics and things like that through Jerry Baker and many others that have done a wonderful job taking care of gnats and ants and other pests, and I haven't used a single chemical. It's just simple things between dish soap and vinegar and things like that that you find in your household. And just wanted to get your comments on what you thought about them.
Well, a couple things. I mean, Jerry Baker's combinations at times I have been somewhat disturbed at, because there are times he's mixing insecticides with things, and other times, I mean, he's just using alcohol. His explanations for things, I guess, don't fit what one expects biologically. But there's two things. My definition of natural is basically there's a number of products that are organic insecticides that have natural heritages. The ground up leaves of this plant, the ground up roots of that. There's a product called spinosad out there now that is derived from a fungus that grows under a rum still in Jamaica, and it has insecticidal properties. And these things are really very good products. Another group of products that are natural that also happen to be food additives are things like clove oil and the like that are known to be contact insect killers and the like. The home remedy stuff, I find hot and cold stuff. I find stuff that I have no reason to believe that they have the kind of products that would work. In other cases, they said, you know, if you're using Listerine, it's the alcohol in there that's killing. It's not any of the other byproducts. So it depends on the individual situation. They are definitely, in some cases, very good products. My comment, though, to people when they're looking at things is, I guess my frustration is that natural to me does not mean non-toxic. I mean, everything has its personality and its issues. And, you know, the safe way is to really do some investigation. And, you know, from the scientific point of things, we can't deal with testimonials. You know, we need some hard science, some trials. And so that's typically when I'm trying to get some evaluation for the efficacy and safety of something, I need somebody that's done some work with it. But when you do look into this, there's lots of things that work. And, you know, so it's kind of interesting. But there are some home remedies, I will tell you, that I will raise my eyes at and say, first of all, they're not safe. Or secondly, I don't expect them to work.
No, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Rebecca. And Barbara in Richland Center, hello to you.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I was wondering, I have a problem again this year like I did last year. I'm getting wasps in, and they're getting bigger.
Okay, what's going on is the wasps that you are seeing are overwintering queens that snuck into your attic or to your walls last fall.
Mm-hmm.
And now with this crazy weather, they're waking up. And so there's no nest per se, but what this tells me is they're getting easy access. And so again, is it a case that you need to screen your vents in your attic so that they can't get in there in the fall, or find where this other weakness is? I see this more commonly. I often get this call for people that are going through constructions in the fall. So they've got their walls opened up, the wasps crawl in, and then they get everything sealed up, and this exact same thing happens. Things warm up, and the wasps come in, and it give them the indication that they've got a nest, but they don't. Unfortunately, there isn't a whole lot you can do now because you don't have access to your walls.
Right.
But as I said, what it tells me is start thinking about, you know, is it your soffits, your overhangs? There's some place that they're finding an easy way of crawling into the fall, because that's what they do, is they hide under rocks and in wood piles and other things to get through the winter typically, and then they start everything from scratch somewhere next spring. And so what this underlines, as I said, they're getting easy access. So I check all my vents to make sure they're screened. If there's any loose siding, you want to tighten that up so they can't get access that way. And in general, wasps tend to go high. So I would look there more so than lower on the house for this structural weakness.
Oh, great. I've got a few vents that I know don't have any screen on them.
Okay. Well, that you know, something as easy as, you know, you want it to have a small enough mesh that the wasp can't get through. But, you know, the typical kind of window screen is more than fine enough mesh, but you still get your airflow. So.
Yep. Great. There you go. Good luck. Thank you, Barbara, for calling. Steve in Algonquin, Illinois, it is on to you now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Grain weevils. I have little half-inch moths, gray moths, flying around my house. I've had this problem before. A few months ago, I bought a 5-pound bag of flour, put it in a Tupperware container after taking it out of the original packaging, and a couple of weeks later, I found the little larva crawling around inside that. Well, they couldn't have escaped, but what do you do for these things other than throw out everything in your pantry, fumigate the place, and start over again?
Okay. Couple species. Weevils are a type of beetle. And the only place you find weevils is in whole grain. But For the granary weevils. But whether you've got Mediterranean flower moth or Indian meal moth, which are two common critters associated with stored products, I'm not into spraying for these. I tell people, if you got a bad box of Bisquick, you can spray all you want and you still got, you got critters. But it is a combination of going through things, what is obviously infested. It's got webbing, it's got worms you dispose of.
Right.
For things that you go through in a 2 or 3 week period of time, breakfast cereal, it's about a 6 or 7 week process. So I don't worry about those. But things that you have around for an extended period of time, do much like you did in the Tupperware. You need substantial packaging. And we're talking plastic containers, glassware, and the like.
Right.
So that things stay contained. And the biggest problem with these is you've got containers, you know, spice boxes and you know, pancake batter, that all they are basically glued cardboard boxes with a very thin papery thing. And so the problem with these things, they lay their eggs on the outside and they start infesting new things. And so it's kind of like putting out little fires all the time.
Okay.
And so that's why in
so
the
they
other,
don't even have, they don't even have to be laying the eggs in the product. They can be laying it on the outside of the packaging.
Right.
When the larvae hatch out, they tunnel in.
Right. So now one of the things, though, you can do with some of the stuff is you can put things in the freezer for 4 or 5 days. If anything was infested, that would kill them. Sometimes people, things that are particularly susceptible, they'll leave in the refrigerator or freezer just because things can't develop. But, you know, you can't, you can't have all your dry goods in there. But usually if you go through, and the only thing I see that throws a curve at people is they don't think of other plant-based products in the house that are not food. Things like potpourri, dried flower arrangements, all those things have the right kind of food to sustain some of these grain moths.
Okay, and basically so, carbohydrates.
Right. So, you know, usually if you go through the cleanup, you put things in protected packaging, it should, life should really improve within 2 to 3 weeks. If not, they've found something else. And you know, we look at bird seed and pet food. And as I said, that there's really a wide variety of food substrates they can get into. And,
right.
But the spraying, what I don't like about the spraying is that you can't spray the food directly, and that's the source of the problem.
Secondly,
if you pull everything, you know, in order to spray your cupboards, you got to pull everything out. You spray it, you let it dry, and then you put it back in. So there's an awful lot of handling things. And as I said, it really doesn't approach the problem directly at all. So I'm not a fan at all of spraying for food-based pests. But as I said, once you understand it's anything that's plant-based, you do your detective work, you should be able to beat it.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn back to Facebook for a minute, Phil. We've got another photograph. This is a really strange one here. Any idea what that is?
Okay, so I know it's a caterpillar, and I am guessing, because I don't have a good size reference, it is an inchworm, or what we call a geometrid moth. Inchworms don't have the full complement of legs that normal caterpillars do, and so I can see the legs on the back, but I don't see the middle legs. And so the other thing is many of these are incredibly good camouflage mimics as sticks and the like.
This is amazing.
So this thing, you know, it even has, in some cases, you swear, are little buds or little twigs sticking off of it.
Yeah.
And so, and when you disturb them, they play possum. So they just sit there. And so you can see why they are quite well protected. So as I said, it is a species of inchworm. Now, technically, there's well over 100 species in the state. So which one it is, I'm not going to venture a guess yet. But that if you look under inchworm, now, here's a case. You know, one of my favorite places to go on the internet, there's a place called Bug Guide. And Bug Guide is a wonderful resource that has literally, I'm sure, millions of pictures. Now, if you didn't know what this critter is and went to look for it in Bug Guide, it would take you months to go through all their pictures. But knowing that it's an inchworm, I think if the person would go to Bug Guide, put inchworm caterpillar and look through, they may even find the species that's involved, because there'll be lots of really neat pictures. It's one of these sites where people put pictures in, they kind of add it to the database, and so it just keeps bigger and bigger. And it's very useful if you kind of know what you're looking for. It's rather frustrating if you don't know what you're looking for.
Bobby and Madison, hello to you.
Hi there. About last summer, we had a flea infestation, and I can't seem to get rid of it. I thought they were gone, and now all of a sudden they're back.
Do you have dogs or cats or anything? Or
we have 3 cats and a dog.
Okay. I'll give you the wild scenario first. I've run into these cases where the real source of the fleas were not the pets, but wild animals. Both possums and raccoons carry cat fleas. So people bomb the house, treat the pets, and it keeps coming back because their chimney is infested. So that's the wild case. The other one, though, is typically people with cats have a harder time. And if you understand the flea biology, fleas breed where the cats or animals spend rest in times. It's the blood that the adult fleas are emitting that feed their larvae. And cats, because of their behavior, are just notorious for getting under beds, going down in the basement, getting back in a corner. And unless you get to that, quote, hot spot, you never completely clean it up. And so, treating the animal helps to reduce the populations, treating the breeding sites. But if you don't get to all the breeding sites, and these breeding sites are very isolated. So if you know your cat's behavior and where they like to crawl into, and if it's back in a closet, you got to get on your hands and knees and get down to the floor of the closet and treat it to successfully get the problem under control. We don't see a lot of resistance problems anymore. We used to 20, 30 years ago when we had different products we were using. But generally speaking, the kind of products we've got have been performing very well. And to me, again, it's a case of either a wild animal source or there is one breeding spot you're not getting to, and that continues to throw the infestation back at you.
So a little more detective work you need to do.
If it were a wild animal source, how would I go about getting rid of that? Because I do think that we have a mouse and a rat problem.
Okay, tell you what, we'll ponder that. We'll ponder that and stay listening, Bobby, and we'll be back with Phil right after a look at the news. Stick around.
WPR.org's audio archive makes it easy to listen to our programs whenever you want to. Every day, many programs are saved so you can catch something you missed or just listen again. Visit WPR.org and click on Audio Archives.
Shopping at your local farmer's market, running a 5K for charity, the things that help you are all the more rewarding when they also help a whole community, like being a sustaining member of Wisconsin Public Radio. Set up an ongoing monthly contribution and your gift will inform and entertain more than 200,000 people who listen every day. Go to WPR.org and click donate or call 800-383-9772.
The time now is 12 noon. A quick look at Wisconsin weather for today. Mostly sunny skies with high temperatures in the upper 20s to the low 30s.
Even with the colder temperatures, there's still lots of insect activity out there. Unfortunately, much of it has moved indoors. Sometimes it's hard to know what's cause for concern and what's just an inconvenience. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Lucky to have Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, with us. Got lots of great information to share, and he will answer your questions as well. Easy to do. To get to him, just call at 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@wpr.org as well. And don't forget to check our Facebook page. For that, you need to go to The Larry Mueller Show. You can post your comments and photos there. And if you like the page, click like while you're there. We're going to send you updates on upcoming show topics. Hope you'll do that. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Phil and I are both going to be at the Garden Expo this weekend. Phil's there pretty much all weekend. He and I are going to be on board at from 10 to 11 in the morning with Shelley Ryan and some other folks talking gardening, obviously. And then I'll be at the Wisconsin Public Radio booth, and a lot of people are going to be at that booth over the weekend. I know Scott Craven, for example, is going to be there Saturday, I think around noon or 1, and he's bringing a bunch of stuffed animals of one sort or another, and he's going to be happy to talk with you, and I know a lot of other folks are as well. We'll be posting a whole list of those on our Facebook page, so hope you'll come out and see us. Dave, we had a flea question. I want to get back to that.
The listener had mentioned that they had mice and rat problems, and although there are fleas associated with those species, they're different fleas. And so my guess, again, it is the cat flea, which we find on dogs, cats, and potentially these wild animals. Now, typically when people have this problem, either you've heard something in the attic, you've heard something in your crawl space, or as I said, if you're using your fireplace, forget it, because the raccoons could not survive that. But that has been my experience a number of times, finding raccoons in little used fireplaces. And then you literally have to both convince the raccoon to leave, but then get in and get that cleaned out. Maybe not sprayed. Sometimes a good vacuum cleaning and just getting that stuff out will help a lot. But there are sprays that can be used, but it gets tricky. But I only threw that out because in those cases where it just didn't make sense, people that don't have pets and have cat fleas, there's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
Or again, cases where people are doing everything right and it just seems not to get better, you start to wonder where the source would be. And we said either the wild animals or, again, in the case of cats, there is one little hot spot back in a corner somewhere you're not thinking about, and that's where they're sustaining themselves and reinfesting the house.
We have Dave in Eau Claire next with a question for you. Dave, hi.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious. My son's had a moth problem in his closet. He says they're really small moths. They're kind of a light brown to a white. And he says they appear, and then all of a sudden they'll just disappear. Him and his girlfriend have cleaned out the closet completely and haven't been able to figure out where they're coming from. Could you tell me what they are and maybe how to control them?
Yeah, would have to see the moth for sure, but I will tell you that probably 90% of the moths I see are grain-based moths in a house that are associated with either pet food, bird seed. But I'll again throw you, I've been doing this such a long time that I've seen some interesting things. Going back to the mouse and rat thing. I've had cases where mice have stole the pet food from the family pet and stashed it in the walls. And then all of a sudden we have a food base for my grain-based insects. And so sometimes, the source is not obvious. And as I said, so that's just a wild one. But there's been more than one time I've talked to people that, yes, well, we had quite a mouse problem. And yes, we couldn't leave the food out too long because the mice would steal it from our dog. That would make me nervous as a food source. Also looking into... Again, Christmas wreaths made out of walnuts or other kind of art objects that have plant-based things and seeds or leaves or whatnot as being the source. And you just don't think of that. But if most of the problem is in the closet, the source has to be the closet. The moths do fly around, but wherever they seem to be most numerous has to be close to the food source. And now it's just being enough of a detective of figuring it out. I've literally had people tell me it turned out to be a granola bar in the winter coat that they never use is being the food source for a problem like this. So it does take sometimes some pretty in-depth detective work to figure it out.
Okay. Would those moths be chew on clothes then too?
The clothes moth, which... There's two species, and I'm starting to see more than I used to earlier in my career. It has to be wool, or it has to be silk or mohair, something of natural animal-based. All our synthetics and whatnot are not a food substrate, and one would assume you'd see holes in your wool coat. You see these little casings that the moths make. So as I said, and the thing about that moth, it's even smaller, and if it's looked at very closely, it's more of a kind of a golden gray color. More often what I see with clothes moths is people see the damage and not the moths themselves, whereas the grain-based moths, it's the other way. You often see the moths, and then you're trying to figure where these little stinkers are coming from.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Email from Judy, who they enjoy our show and live on a Christmas tree farm in northeast Iowa and have identified the swooping bug, which annoys them every winter, as a leaf-footed pine seed bug. Mm-hmm. Any ideas about eliminating this harmless pest?
Well, the Christmas tree farm is probably, they feed on the seeds of pine and spruce, and so you have to have the conifers there. But their claim to fame is they're a fall invader. So again, it's kind of, you got to draw the line in the sand in the fall and either make sure they don't crawl in, or you can spray the outside of the structure, especially the sunny sides of the structure, with the same kind of sprays we use for Asian lady beetle or for box elder bugs, and thereby stop them. I, again, as the earlier listener was talking about the wasp problem, I would make sure that my vents that go into the attic and into the soffits are screened properly, because that might be where they're squeezing through. And again, they're just looking for shelter, but then when they warm up, that's when they filter down into the living space through light fixtures and other kinds of things. And so, as I said, mm-hmm. I think if you realize that it's a fall invasion, and somewhere around the 1st to 15th of September, as I guess, is when I would make sure that I would, if I was using the sprays, spray the outside.
Susan in Mequon, on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had about a 8-inch tall cylindrical plastic container with sesame seeds. And it must have been in my cupboards for a very long time, because when I pulled it out in probably early December, I found the most amazing cobwebs, again from this moth that you're talking about, the little one that eats grains. And because it was all contained, I took away the plastic wrapper so that I have like my own little ant farm. And I've been watching them for 6 to 8 weeks now. So it has this like inside, it almost looks like a small tornado made of a wonderful woven web that they make that goes up the whole inside of this. And I've seen the larvae, and okay, and I've seen the actual moth, and I think I saw them mating. Okay, so my question is, now the larvae, I'm thinking that they're going to turn into this moth. They're kind of in a cocoon now along the side. You know, they're stuck to the sides. And is that where the moth will come out of that larvae that's in that little cocoon there?
Yes.
Okay, and what does the larvae, I'm trying to find the seeds here. How does the larvae, where does it come from?
Well, basically the moth will lay very tiny little eggs, and the moths are attracted to that webbing that was left behind, because that's where a food source is, although they will lay them elsewhere. And so the whole life cycle at normal room temperatures is about 6 to 7 weeks. But if things are cooler, it can be slowed down. If things were excessively warm, it could be shortened. And, you know, what you may consider, you know, my concern here, I mean, it's kind of fun to watch, but if you want to save the artistic side of things, you can always put this in the freezer for about 5 to 6 days to kill everything that's in the sesame seeds.
Oh, I'm actually loving watching how they develop now, because they can't get out.
Okay.
I wonder how long can I...
But
keep...
Well, yeah, I either they're going to exhaust the food source eventually, and then they'll starve to death.
Okay.
And one you'll start to see is the moths start to... You know, there'll be all kinds of moth scales and other things. I mean, things get kind of cloudy, I find, when they're heavily infested over time. I mean, the normal behavior of this moth is when the larvae are done feeding, they will often try to migrate a distance away before they spin their cocoons down. So I can see a number of samples. People will send me napkins and baby diapers and whatnot that have these grain moth cocoons in, and they think that they're feeding on the paper-based stuff, and they can't. What it tells me is they got a box of bird seed or pet food close by
somewhere
in the cupboards,
nearby.
And these things have just kind of crawled out. And so given the opportunity. But if you have them totally contained, you're fine. But as I said, eventually they will run out of food, and then that will be done.
That's the end of them. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call, Susan. And Jan and Madison, I'm going to turn to you next. Hi, Jan.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hello. Good morning. I have two questions. How do I tell the difference between a bee and a wasp? Because I imagine there are 100 types of bees.
The quickest way, if you can get a close look at the critter, is... Generally speaking, bees are fuzzy. In fact, most bees, the hairs on their body are plumed like a feather. They're forked. Whereas wasps may have occasional bristles, but when you look at a wasp very closely, they tend to be pretty smooth skin with just a few black hairs sticking out. So that's, to me, the easiest character.
Okay. Then my second question is, we have a cottage near Wautoma, and it's on the exterior wood siding, there's a hole about a dime size hole, and I don't know if they're, I think they're wasps that are entering there, and they've been coming and going, and I've just let it go on for 3 or 4 years, and now I thought, you know, maybe I should just, they're accumulating. They're not coming into the interior of the cottage. I don't know what's happening up in the attic, however, or what's happening in the cavity there. And I thought, well, if I close that hole now, will they eat their way into the interior?
No, because the only species of bee or wasp that we have in the state that spends the winter as a colony with numerous individuals is the honeybee. Everybody else gets through the winter some other way, mostly with queens that have to start everything from scratch, and they often don't have any allegiance. I guess my one question to you in this hole that they've been utilizing, in the late summer, do you see lots of critters coming and going, or is it just an occasional?
I see a steady stream of them entering in the evening.
Okay, the interesting thing then is that I'm a little surprised, since they start everything from scratch and they don't come back to the old nesting site is that you have been unfortunate enough that a queen has found that access point and started a new colony each year. So you're perfectly fine in plugging it up anytime from now, well into June, in fact, you would be okay. And you deny them access, and you shouldn't have any problem at all.
There you go.
Now, if we were in the fall of the year, that would be a big mistake, because that would drive them in. Because then you got a whole colony, and everybody wants to do something. But they die out by the 1st of November. So as I said, plug it up.
There you go. We have Deanna on our Facebook page, bought a dog toy, and when the dog tore it open, a large roach walked out of it.
Ooh, good.
Do I need to be concerned about eggs in the toy? I mean, just get rid of the toy.
Probably not. Yeah. Probably not. Now, you know, depending on which roach species, you know, there's four common potential roaches we get. I only see that the German cockroach is the most likely one to set. Some of these are kind of tropical roaches. And I do see occasionally things coming up from Texas, and they just don't go anywhere. And, you know, it could have been a male, which wouldn't have any eggs. The eggs of a cockroach are, we call it an ootheca. It's like an egg purse. It's relatively big. It's like a very large match head with segmentations in. You would see it. So it's something you could clean up quite readily. And so, as I said, I just wouldn't worry.
And Ratch wonders if you would ease the mind here on the bed bug issue. What about spraying ourselves with DEET before going to sleep in hotels?
Bed bugs don't respond to DEET.
No. Huh.
You know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, it's the mechanisms of how DEET works against mosquitoes, and bed bugs don't seem to use the same. Now, I've seen some discussion that there are products in development that will work somewhat as repellents, but they're not here yet. And so, you know, I think the thing that people need to educate themselves for is what bed bug waste and things look like on a bed frame or a mattress, and inspect for those kind of things in the hotel. And, you know, other than that, you know, it the chance of it finding it in a hotel, at least the figures I have seen, still suggest it's about 1%. You know, so it is relatively low, and the hotels have become much more educated and much more aggressive at catching these things early, because, of course, it's in their best interest to prevent the infestations from going. And now the other side of it, as we've talked about before on the show, why the bed bug problem keeps expanding, and it's not hotels as much now as in residential settings and, you know, apartments, is the combination of insecticide resistance, or our sprays are not working very well, and many of the treatments, like the heat treatments, which are quite effective, are quite expensive. So there's a big resource issue. I mean, when an apartment treatment costs $1,200, you know, you can see why people just don't have the resources to address it up front, and the like. And so these things continue. And part of it, again, culturally, we're all learning on this, because, you know, most of us didn't grow up with exposure to this. And so we do some things sometimes, like pick up used furniture and the like, without looking and inspecting, and we're bringing the problems home with us.
Is there a preventive action that Carol from Green Bay can take in spring to keep slugs from chewing the leaves of her plants?
There are slug baits. And what I generally look at, since the slugs are overwintering under rocks and things, if we have a somewhat dry spring, it's pretty hostile for them. They don't do well. If we have a wet spring, honestly, that's slug heaven, and they start going. So if you have an area that's shady, is slug prone, there are baits that are sold. There is an iron phosphate bait. There's a methaldehyde bait. These are sprinkled in the areas that they frequent, and the slugs, when come in contact with it, die. And so the slug baits are the way to go. Insecticides don't work. They are not insects, and insecticides don't work. The problem here is, if something were to kill slugs as a spray, you worry about it having potential earthworm toxicity. Now, with these baits, we've got the product a little bit more confined, so that it's not a broadcast going on. And I have found them to be quite effective. The only dilemma is that if it rains a lot, the baits fall apart. So you've got the ideal condition for the slugs, and the preventative we're using doesn't work well. Although you'll see in some of the garden catalogs, they sell these little slug dishes. They're basically the baits inside. It's protected from the outside rain, but yet the slugs still get attracted to it. And, you know, the old home remedies of beer baiting and whatnot are options too. But again, be aggressive in the spring, because that's when the adult females are coming out. I always found it funny, because the books always talked about slugs overwinter as eggs. And in the spring, when it warms up, the first rock I pick up, there's a slug under there. So, I, you know, the slugs aren't reading the same books as I am. So,
Wow. And the tick spray product name, have been asking
about
that.
The active ingredient is permethrin. Now, one of the more common names I've seen it sold under is Permanone, P-E-R-M-O-N-E, but I guarantee you there's numerous other sprays out there that contain this active ingredient. And again, if it's registered for on-skin use, you know it's not the right stuff because this permethrin spray is only a clothing spray. What they recommend is to spray the clothing when it's not on your person, let it dry, then you put it on. And although it's interesting is the same active ingredient is in head lice shampoos and the like. It has many, many registrations. But as I said, for the tick type products, go to the sporting goods store and just look for tick sprays. And again, as long as it doesn't say DEET, to be honest, it's probably going to be permethrin.
Jim in Bayfield County, hello to you.
Oh, hello. Listen, I've had this, I've actually had a relationship with an insect. It started last September. My partner and I heard it singing. It's a musical chirp. She thought it might be a bird, but I thought it was an insect. You could hear it for 50, 60 feet away probably, quite loud, slow, methodical, cheep, cheep, cheep. But anyway, so when we brought our plants in, we live up here in the forest. We brought them in the fall. Lo and behold, one of them, or the one, got in one of the plants, apparently, and it's still singing. A couple of weeks go by, in the middle of the night, you'll hear it cheep, or in the middle of the day, and I'm starting to feel sorry for the thing. You know, it's looking for a mate, and I'm feeling, what should I do?
Well, you know, my first guess, it might be a snowy tree cricket.
Oh.
Now, it doesn't have to be. There are other critters, and, you know, it gets tough. Sometimes at first, when you were talking, I thought, well, maybe it was a katydid, but
no, I know that it's not a katydid.
Yeah, but it could even be field crickets. You know,
I thought cricket right away.
I get this quite commonly because when crickets do sneak in sometimes in the fall and are down in the basement. And again, you know, if you're a light sleeper, that's not the best thing to have something making noise down there.
But I'm real familiar. I've always lived in the country, and I know crickets really well. Mm-hmm. You know, this is much slower than a cricket, and it's more musical. And it's repetitive, and it's quite loud. And anyway, it's looking
more
for
like a
mate.
Chirp then.
Yeah. Well, definitely. You know, you can now with the internet. There are, you know, if you go under insect sounds, I think you can find some websites. You could probably try to match it up. You know, we had talked about Songs of Insects, which is a book came out about 4 or 5 years ago that has basically a CD with all the singing critters that we've gotten in the Midwest. In fact, in the whole East. But without hearing it exactly, as I said, to me it's got to be out of that cricket group of one sort or another.
Did you say snowy tree cricket?
Yeah, snowy tree cricket is a group of crickets that we get that are often associated with plant material.
Oh, well, thank you.
You might try finding that sound, the sound of a snowy tree cricket. You'll find it online and see if you can match it up. Good luck, Jim. Thank you for calling. Tony in Fort Atkinson. Hello to you.
Hello. Last summer I had a bunch of squash bugs and ended up pulling out my zucchini and stuff mid-summer because it was just everything was dying.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do this year to prevent that?
Well, one of the things that you could have tried, unfortunately, we're past the time, but squash bugs overwinter as adults. And people, because they're looking for shelter things, have had some luck by taking an old shingle or an old board and putting it in the garden. The squash bugs crawl underneath it. It's basically working as a squash bug trap. And then you pick it up and you smush the little devils. The other thing I'll tell you, though, is because they overwinter as adults, is the first squash plants you put out, that's the ones you want to protect. You know, and there are organic sprays and more conventional sprays. But if you can kill that first wave of adults, you'll make a big difference. What probably happened to you is they laid eggs and it was their children that overwhelmed you. So as I said, I know right away when the plants go out, the adults will be looking for plants to start that first generation. And the young green nymphs seem to be quite susceptible to soapy water sprays. As they get bigger, they get harder to kill because they get thicker skinned. And as I said, then you got to be a little more careful of what products you use.
Okay.
All right.
Any brand that you would recommend?
You know, generally most insecticides are pretty good. The one product that it would be interesting looking at the label, and this depends if you're inclined to use chemicals, but Bayer has a group of systemic insecticide that does have fruit and vegetable labels. And, you know, you put it on the plant, the roots uptake it, and then sucking insects like this critter would be susceptible. Now, this works great in the spring because it has a relatively long harvest restriction. It is not appropriate as we get later in the summer because there's just not enough time. You have to wait. And mm-hmm. again, it's often like 21-day harvest restriction. But the Bayer Advanced product, I would look at the label to see if squash is on the label. I know it's got raspberries and a few other things, and I would assume squash wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, Bayer as in like Bayer
B-A-Y-E-R,
aspirin.
B-A-Y-E-R, yes.
Yeah, like the it's actually the same company, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
That makes the aspirin. So there you go. Thank you so much for that question. Appreciate it. Boy, Phil, we well, tell you what, we're about out of time here. There was somebody saw an insect in the snow, looked like about a mosquito size. In 10 seconds, if you get
winter crane fly. We have a wingless species of crane fly that you will find on the snow. Great big long gangly legs, and they are an aquatic insect. And if you didn't know what you were looking at, you would never guess it was a fly because they are wingless.
Oh, well, you'll come back and be with us again.
Yes.
And I'll see you Saturday.
Yes, and I'm talking at 1 o'clock on Saturday and 2 o'clock on Sunday, and I will be over in the next to the WHA booth. We have all the Horticulture Group Extension will be there, so we'll have plant pathologists, soil scientists, all kinds of people. Master
yeah.
gardeners. So,
thanks, Phil. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, and look for him this weekend at the Garden Expo. Thanks for listening.